This is Talkish. I am Hallie Kasserchain. The Hallie Kasserchain Show is always available online at HallieKasserChain.com. Now, let's get to it. On episode 311, a provocative question. Can Christianity survive Trump? And another question. How is it that against all odds, Judaism has survived? A look at religion in these fractious times. When joining me today is, up first, the controversial religion historian Bart Ehrman, the author of a thought-provoking new book, The Triumph of Christianity. And in our second half hour, a conversation with Rabbi Michael Bernholtz of Temple Beth Shalom, Vero Beach, Florida. It's time for a Talkish. Let's get to it. In his new book, The Triumph of Christianity, Bart Ehrman, a leading authority on early Christianity, investigates the story of how Christianity grew from a religion of 20 or so peasants in rural Galilee to the dominant religion in the West in less than 400 years. He opines that Christianity didn't have to become the dominant religion in the West. It easily could have remained a sect of Judaism with little historical significance. Instead, the religion, whose first believers were 20 or so illiterate day laborers in a remote part of the empire, became the official religion of Rome, converting some 30 million people in just 4 centuries, becoming what Ehrman says is the single most important cultural transformation our world has ever seen. Bart Ehrman is the author of more than 20 books, including the New York Times bestselling Misquoting Jesus and God's Problem. He's the James A. Gray Distinguished Professor of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and has been featured in Time and has appeared on Dateline NBC, The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, CNN, The History Channel, and more. It's time for Talkish. Let's talk with author and historian Bart Ehrman. So let's begin here. Let's talk Christianity. You know, there's some who might call me heretical for saying this, but is it possible that Christianity was the first idea, religion, to go viral? Have you thought of that?
Yeah, well, that's how we originally thought we would promote the book, is that it absolutely went viral, and there was nothing like it before. Never was a religion that took over an entire empire the way Christianity took over the Roman world.
You know, it is fascinating. If you think of it in terms of that, it does place a slightly different, color on it, if you will. The title of the book is The Triumph of Christianity. And, you know, we could go 1,000 ways on that word, the triumph. But since you chose the title, I want to know exactly what you meant by triumph.
So when I wrote the book, I wanted to talk about how Christianity became the dominant religion of the empire. And, you know, from a Christian point of view, they certainly won out. I mean, they were trying to defeat the other religions, and they did so. So it is a triumph from that sense. But I also say in the book that I don't try to write the book from a triumphalist point of view, by which I mean it's not that I'm celebrating the fact that Christianity won. I'm simply giving the historical information about how it happened. And in my view, there are absolutely good things that came out of it. I mean, whether you're a Christian or not, I mean, we all cherish our heritage, our music and our art and our literature, our philosophy. We cherish these things which were made incalculably different by the triumph of Christianity, but there were also things lost in the process. And so in the book, I talk about both things that were won and things that were lost.
I was interested in your saying that the triumph in terms of art and culture and things like that. What do you mean by that specifically?
Well, you can take any of these areas. I mean, you just take music. I mean, the classical music that we know and love, you know, you couldn't have had a Bach or a Mozart without Christianity. I mean, because their art forms, their forms of music are developments out of the earlier forms of music that came down through the Middle Ages, and all the music in the Middle Ages came out of Christian monasteries. It's a very Christian form, and so the kinds of Western culture we have, you can say the same thing with art. I mean, just think about medieval art or art in the Renaissance. I mean, it's Christian. or literature. You can't understand literature without understanding Christianity. So my point isn't that we wouldn't have had any music or literature or art without Christianity. What I'm saying is that what we cherish in our culture can't be understood apart from understanding that Christianity was the dominant cultural force of the West for many, many centuries.
The only reason I say that is because there are certainly many Jews and others who created great art and great music as well. So I was lost.
Absolutely.
I was lost in that.
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. There was great pagan art too. And
right.
And you know, one of the problems is that so much of that pagan art was destroyed. And so that was a loss. So I'm not saying that it's necessarily a good thing that our culture was dominated by Christianity, but it is a historical reality that it was. And that's what makes the subject of this book so important, I think, is to understand how that happened.
Here's another, this is just how my mind works, Bart. The book subtitle is How a Forbidden Religion Swept the World. Speak to us in terms of the context of forbidden. Me being who I am, I have to ask about the forbidden aspect. You know, some people are to that which is forbidden, sort of like flies to fly paper. You know, maybe I'm fooling with you, maybe
yeah,
I'm not.
Right.
But what about, that being said, why should it matter to anyone that Christianity took over the Roman Empire? Talk to me in all this.
Well, I think if it was just a matter of Christianity taking over the empire in the first 400 years of Christianity, if that was the extent of the matter, then it would just be in interest of people who are, you know, historically oriented, who have certain kind of strange antiquarian interests, you know, people like me. But the point is, the one I was saying earlier, is that when it took over the Roman Empire, it became the religion of Western civilization. So, of course, there were other religions. I mean, Jews continued to live and down through the ages, and there are other religions. Islam rose and all that. But the reality is that our entire cultural heritage is dependent on the fact that Christianity took over the Roman world. If they didn't, then the Roman world would have remained pagan, which means polytheistic. Islam never would have risen, and the world today would be polytheistic. And so everything that we cherish in our culture would have been completely different, not just a little bit different. It would have been unrecognizable. So I think it's a really important question about how it happened.
Judaism was a monotheistic religion.
Yes, it was.
Right.
And still is.
Right. Exactly. I guess I'm just saying to you, so where is Christianity different in terms of what you're proposing here?
Two things. I mean, Christianity, of course, started out as a form of Judaism. Jesus-ish, his followers were Jewish. They kept the Jewish law. They observed Jewish customs. They worshiped the Jewish God. They revered the Jewish scriptures, and they were Jewish. And after Jesus died, some of his followers said he got raised from the dead, and they came to believe that he was the Jewish Messiah. And so, but they thought that since Jesus was the Jewish Messiah, sent from the Jewish God to the Jewish people, in fulfillment of the Jewish scriptures, to follow Jesus, you had to be Jewish. And so that meant that anyone who believed in Jesus had to convert to Judaism. That if you're a man, you had to be circumcised. Male or female, you had to keep the Sabbath and observe kosher food laws and so on. So Christianity started out as a Jewish religion, worshiping the Jewish God. But it ended up splitting with Judaism. It split over Judaism principally over the question of who Jesus really was, because Christians wanted to claim he was the Messiah, and non-Christian Jews thought that was crazy. The Jewish Messiah, there were various expectations of what the Messiah was going to be, but all of them thought that he was going to be a figure of grandeur and power who would destroy the enemies and set up God's kingdom in Jerusalem. Jesus certainly didn't do any of that. He didn't destroy the enemies. He was arrested and humiliated and publicly tortured to death. So, you know, that was just the opposite of the Messiah. And so most Jews absolutely didn't accept the Christian claim, which is what led Christianity then to become a different religion from Judaism, a non-Jewish religion.
I'm going to divert to the Emperor Constantine now, because this is important to the story that you tell in this terrific book. And by the way, I want to tell people that this is eminently readable. This is so deliciously readable. I have to give you credit for this, because what could be virtually very boring, maybe, if you're not
yes,
a scholarly top.
It's amazing how it's amazing how boring you can make things. Yeah.
You're right, but you don't do that, and I want everybody to know that I started up to just start to read a little bit of it, and then I went, no, wait a minute, this is divine. Keep going. But so I'm glad. I want to sell that for you, and so there I go. But let's go back to Constantine, because I think this is important, and I know you think it's important, so talk to me about Emperor Constantine.
Yeah, well, you know, when I started doing my work on the book, this book was a long time coming, but when I first started thinking about how Christianity took over the empire, I thought what a lot of people still think today, which is that the reason Christianity succeeded was because the Emperor Constantine converted. Constantine was the emperor in the early 4th century, and during a period of persecution, he became a Christian. What I argue in the book is that Constantine's conversion, in fact, is not what made the difference. To my surprise, I came to realize that. And the reason is because at the rate Christianity was growing at the time, it almost certainly would have taken over the empire whether Constantine converted or not. If he hadn't converted, probably one of his successors would have converted, because it was on this upward path that it was going to take over the empire. And so I argue that Constantine's conversion is important for other reasons. The most important one is that Christianity had been experiencing a very severe persecution for about 9 years or 10 years at this point. And Constantine, when he converted, made it a illicit religion and started showering favors on it. And so that made a difference. But it would have taken over anyway, is what I argue.
Paganism fascinates me. As you said earlier, we've lost a lot of that, partly to Christians, partly to Muslims, you know, whatever. I mean, it's a sad story. There isn't as much of that, you know, history still abounds. But talk to me about what they actually believed. They believed, I'll ask you, just that's the question. Talk to me a little bit about them. Yeah, I think it's important.
Yeah. It is. And, you know, when historians use the term pagan or paganism, they don't mean anything negative by it. It's simply a way to refer to people in the ancient world who are neither Jewish nor Christian. In other words, everybody, 93 to 95% of the population is pagan. And by that, they mean anybody who follows any of the polytheistic religions of antiquity. Ancient pagans believed in many gods, and different people believed in different gods in different places. There were the great gods, like you find in the Greek and Roman mythology. There were city gods, and there were gods of the family, and gods of every function, gods of weather, gods of healing, gods of everything. And so the reason people worshiped the gods, many people didn't believe in an afterlife at all. The reason they worshiped the gods is because the present life is so hard. It's very difficult in the ancient world. If there wasn't any rain this year, your village would starve to death next year. There was obviously no modern medicine. I mean, so anyone who got a tooth abscess was probably going to die. Women were dying in childbirth, and children weren't surviving birth. And so the reason you worship the gods is because they can provide you with the things you can't provide for yourself. They can provide rain. They can make the crops grow, the livestock multiply. They can heal you if you're sick. And so the gods are worshipped, and pagans worship many gods because there are many things that the gods can do, and they're different gods for different functions.
Yeah, and I do think that's fascinating, because I think I'm so angry right now about religion. That's my problem. I'm putting in my birth. I'm very angry. You probably could pick up my energy about it. Everybody's right. Everybody else is wrong. You know, there's no tolerance. It's totally intolerant. But that's baked in, and it goes back to the times you're writing about in this book. And so I was one of the reasons I really did want to talk to you about that. At what point did this intolerance... Christians intolerant.
Yeah.
What is the whole, what is that?
Well, yeah, no, it's actually a central part of the book, because one of the points about paganism is that since it was polytheistic, there was no one who had a sense that since I'm right, you're wrong. If you're a polytheist, you might think that your gods are great and that it'd be great if someone else worshipped your gods, but if somebody decides to start worshipping your gods, they don't have to give up their own gods, because you're a polytheist. You can worship as many gods as you want. Christians inherited from Judaism, they're monotheists. And unlike Jews, Christians were missionary. They wanted to convert people. And so they tried to convince people to convert, because Christians thought that it's only faith in Christ that can bring salvation, and that anyone who doesn't believe in Christ is not only going to fail to get divine benefits now, but is going to be punished in the afterlife. Christians develop the idea of heaven and hell as rewards and punishments after death. And so Christians maintained that if you didn't subscribe to their beliefs, the beliefs in the Christian God, you would go to hell. Christians then developed this exclusive kind of religion that was virtually unheard of in the Roman world, where all the other religions were basically tolerant, but Christians insisted that that you had to be their religion, and if you're their religion, you couldn't have any other religion, couldn't worship any other god.
Doesn't sound very Christian to me.
Well, I don't know. It depends which Christian you talk to. You know, I happen to teach in the American South, and there are a lot of people down here who think that, in fact, if you don't follow their religion, you're going to roast in hell forever. And it's what they firmly believe, and they've inherited this from a long history of Christian tradition of claiming that there's only one truth, and you have to accept it, or else you'll pay an eternal consequence.
Yeah, and I think I want to talk about that because I think it's so relevant to where we are today. Coercion, which is a horrible word, but isn't that part and parcel of everything the conversions were about back in the day that you're writing about?
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, I actually have a chapter on coercion in my book, and what I'll say about it is that I don't think that Christians were trying forcibly to convert anybody. So it's not that they broke out the sword and, you know, said, you know, convert or die. That sort of thing didn't happen. What did end up happening is kind of an irony in history, which is when the Christians were being persecuted because they refused to worship the state gods, which is why Christians were being persecuted, because it wasn't that pagans thought that Christians shouldn't worship the Christian God. Is that whatever God you worship, you need to worship the state gods, because the state gods are the ones that make the state great, and if you don't worship the state gods, it's a political statement. And so Christians were persecuted for that reason. When Christians were being persecuted occasionally here and there, they insisted that there should be a separation of church and state. The state should just let us worship the way we want to, which is what, of course, people today tend to think. You know, there should be a separation of church and state. But nobody in the ancient world had ever said that before the Christians started saying it. And the Christians were saying it because they wanted the state to leave them alone to practice their religion. But what's ironic is, when the Christians took over the empire and the Roman emperor became a Christian, and then at the end of the 4th century, some decades after Constantine, Christianity was made the state religion of Rome, then the Christians stopped saying there should be a separation of church and state and started arguing that the state should put a halt to paganism. And they forcibly shut down paganism eventually. So there was coercion involved, not in the sense that they were making people become Christian, but they were making it illegal to practice paganism.
I think it's fascinating. Can I play heretical again? I mean, I suppose, here I go, right? Was Jesus the first Jew to lose his faith? I mean,
Was Jesus the first Jew?
You know, I say that, but I there are a lot of ways to interpret all of this, and I don't think that's a silly question. I really don't. I mean, I play it like it is, but I'm not so sure that it's not a real question. I wonder how you would answer that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you know, the way I used to have my students debate the topic resolved. Jesus was a Christian. You know, the idea is, did he leave Judaism to adopt something else? And I personally think the answer to that's no. I think that Jesus, in fact, was a faithful Jew up to his death, and that he had no idea that there was going to be a religion starting in his name afterwards. So Jesus, I think, understood himself to be a Jewish prophet who was called by the Jewish God, who had the correct understanding of the Jewish revealed scriptures, and was Jewish all the way, and that his followers were Jewish all the way. And Christianity doesn't start becoming a different thing until you get to someone like Paul, The Apostle Paul started out as a persecutor of Christians, a Jewish persecutor of Christians, but eventually he had a vision of Christ of some kind and after his death and thought that Jesus had been raised from the dead. But he came to think that Jesus' death and resurrection is what brings about salvation, not being Jewish or keeping the Jewish law, and that anybody could be a follower of Jesus, Jewish or not. And once Paul started saying that, it opened up the door to Christianity being a Gentile religion, religion for non-Jews, which of course is what it became, and then it became its own separate religion. So I'm not saying that Paul invented Christianity, but I'm saying that he had a different understanding of what it meant to be a follower of Jesus that ended up leading to what we think of as Christianity.
I think that's a very important point, and one that's not made often, by the way, in these conversations. So I'm glad that we were able to talk about that. I want to talk about Christianity today with you. Before I reveal you, I'm saving you for last. I thought about that a long time. Should I tell who this guy is and what he's about and where he's come from and where he got to first or last? I'm saving it for last. But so let's just talk about Christianity today. Fundamentalism and the politics of Christians. First of all, I think we are in a huge sea change that, you know, in 1,000 years they're going to look back and this is going to be very important to where Christianity is in the spectrum of things. I think it's a big, big thing going on here. But fundamentalism, the politics of Christians, are you worried about the almost cultish nature that Christianity is taking right now?
Yeah, well, I am a bit worried. And you know, I think what really surprises me most is just how completely ironic it is that fundamentalist Christians are so passionate about certain social and political issues. You know, we all know what they are. I mean, it's abortion, and it's gun control, and it's, you know, anti-LGBTQ. And these are the hot button issues for Christian fundamentalists today. What's striking is none of these issues was an issue for the historical Jesus. And the things the historical Jesus was most invested in terms of personal, social ethics and such, are unrelated to any of that. His concerns were for the poor and the needy, the hungry, the homeless. And those issues are not a concern at all for most fundamentalist Christians. And so it just strikes me as this huge irony that they're proclaiming this deeply committed faith to Jesus, but they don't even accept his social views.
It's not discussed enough. It is not discussed enough. And so who are these people who are out there, you know, Graham's son, all these people, you know, throwing mulligans to a president who does these just ridiculous, horrible things and stands for nothing that the Judeo-Christian world even ever stood for. I mean, right?
Well, that's right. And that's the other irony, is that these are the Christians who came out of what used to be called the moral majority. Well, what is moral about what's happening in Washington right now? I mean, why would people who claim to be part of a moral majority support a president who is completely immoral in every way? I mean, whether you talk about the lies or you talk about the sexual predation or, I mean, what? So, yeah. I find it very frustrating.
And you know, just from being a historian type that you are, and for anybody, like, as I said, to start this, if we're going to look back 1,000 years from now, this may be the end of Christianity, if you will, as we knew it, because it can't survive as to what its core values are if this kind of stuff continues. And I don't know how they rectify this. Have you thought of that? How to fix this?
No, I don't. You know, and it's interesting to see it as a historical phenomenon that the more liberal churches, the ones that are open-minded, the ones that try to stand within the history of Christian tradition, are the ones that are losing members. And it's the fundamentalist churches, the Pentecostal churches, the ones that have these hot-button issues of anti-abortion, anti-gay, gun control, those are the ones taking over. So who knows what's going to happen? But, it's not looking good right now.
No, and it's interesting because you are, as you said, in the South, and I think you see it from an entirely different perspective maybe than I'm up north. Actually, I'm down south, but I'm in the South part that's north. In Florida,
okay.
The further you go north, the further north you go in Florida, the further south you get. I'm in southern Florida, so down here it's not that way.
Right.
But it does fascinate me, and totally. And I've watched people good friends of mine who are fundamentalists, who are Christian, who I love to death, but I'm watching them bend and twist with the wind just to make it all work for them.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, I feel like I've been rolled. Holy roller. I feel like I've been rolled. I feel like, I do. So I'm so glad to have you here to talk about this. Talk about you now. As I said, I wanted to save it to the end. And the reason is because I didn't want it to color people's thoughts of what you were saying as you were saying them. You were talking as a historian, and now let's get a little more personal with you, because your own story is fascinating. Tell us a little bit, real quickly, about where you started and where you are today.
Well, no, I started as a fundamentalist Christian. I mean, I was a very committed, hardcore fundamentalist. I went to Moody Bible Institute in Chicago and believed that the Bible was the inerrant revelation from God. And I held those views for a number of years. I became interested in scholarship. I learned Greek to read the New Testament in Greek, and I learned Hebrew to read the Old Testament in Hebrew, and I started studying the Bible intensely, and I began to realize that the Bible is a very human book. It's got all sorts of human frailty to it. It's got discrepancies and contradictions and historical mistakes and all sorts of things. And so I moved away from my hardcore evangelical beliefs to be a fairly liberal Christian for a number of years, active in a variety of churches, Lutheran or Episcopalian churches. Eventually, about, 20 years ago or so, I left Christianity altogether. I came to a point where I simply could no longer accept the idea that there's a good God who's active in this world, given how much incredible suffering there is in it, with massive starvations and epidemics and earthquakes and famines and hurricanes and tsunamis and whatever. So I had, I'd looked at all, what people say all the time, and I read what the biblical scholars say, what the philosophers say, and what regular folks say. I just didn't buy it anymore. And so I left Christianity altogether. So now I consider myself an agnostic.
And that might be confusing to people to get confused over agnostic versus don't believe God at all. Can you just give us a little on that? Atheist.
Yeah, well, when I became an agnostic, I thought that agnostic and atheist were 2 degrees of the same thing. You know, that agnostics are simply windy atheists, and that atheists are simply arrogant agnostics. That, you know, agnostics say, I don't know, and atheists say, no, there's not. And so I don't think that anymore. What I think now is that agnosticism has to do with what you know, and atheism has to do with what you believe. So if somebody were to ask me, do you know whether there's a superior divine being in the universe? I'd say, no, I don't know. How would I know? I'm an agnostic. But if somebody says, well, do you believe there's one? Then I'd say, no, I don't. I don't think there is. And so I'm both an agnostic and an atheist at the same time.
So am I supposed to ask you, what do you believe?
I believe this life is all there is. And rather than making me despair or become a nihilist, it has brightened up my life considerably. I think that since this life is all there is, that it's not a dress rehearsal for something else. And so I try to cherish life as much as I can for as long as I can. And I try to cultivate all the good things in life, family, friends, loving what I do, loving the world around me. I think it's an amazing place. And I think that a life of love is the best way to live life, and that you can't be fully human unless you are loving, not just for yourself, but loving of other people and taking care of those who are in need. And so my life has a lot more meaning now than it did before, because I think this is the only life I have.
Love it, love it, love it. Funny that I said that. Love it. Love, right? Bottom
love
line.
It. So, yeah, love it. Yeah, right. Love it all.
Love it all. That's it. That's key, you know. And a lot of the schisms that are going on in this world as we see them today would not be happening if we would just get to that one word, love. I want to look at that word triumph again, in terms of triumph as victorious, at least in terms of this country. We could take on the world, but whatever. But where religion and politics never supposed to meet, have met, as we just discussed earlier. Talk to me about that word. What, the triumph of Christianity, ultimately a good thing? Or maybe one man's triumph is another man's loss? Or where are we on that word triumph?
Yeah, well, that's what I think. I think, so by triumph, once again, I'm not using it in a sense that I think it's necessarily a good thing. But, the Europeans triumphed over the Native Americans. And I don't think that's necessarily a good thing, but it's a historical fact. They did. They won. Christianity triumphed over the pagan religions of Rome, and I don't think that that's necessarily a good thing. It had good results. I mean, our entire culture is a result of that, and so that's good. But so much was lost as well. One thing that was lost, by the way, is what we were talking about earlier, is tolerance of religion. The polytheistic religions were tolerant of one another because they didn't have any sense that they were right, so everyone else is wrong. And so religious tolerance got lost with the triumph of Christianity. So I think that's a bad thing. And so much pagan art and literature and architecture all lost. That's a bad thing. So there's both good and bad. But however you calculate that, I think everyone can say that, should say that, Christianity taking over the Roman Empire led to the greatest cultural transformation the world's ever seen.
So you've done all of these books, so many books, such brilliant scholarly works. Oh, my God, the historical value of your stuff. But I have to say, on this one, what did you gain from it? You.
Yeah. Well, I gained an appreciation for the culture that I came out of, and I acquired a kind of sense of loss for, you know, of what disappeared with Christianity taking over the world. I've become far more interested in things like reading the Roman classics, you know, reading novels from ancient Greece and Rome, and reading histories and biographies, and reading about what life was like in the ancient world, and realize, you know, it's an entire civilization that was lost. And when I first thought seriously about writing this book, I was actually in Athens, and I was looking around, and, you know, there's got this, you get the Agora with the Temple of Hephaestus, and you get this reconstructed Stoa, and then you go up onto the Acropolis, and you have the Parthenon, and you have these other temples up there. I was looking around and realizing, you know, this was arguably the greatest culture the ancient world had ever seen, and it was, in effect, destroyed when Christianity took over. Oh, my God, so much loss. And so that was kind of a breathtaking moment for me.
I've been speaking with Bart Ehrman. His book, The Triumph of Christianity, How a Forbidden Religion Swept the World. For more information about Mr. Ehrman and his work, visit his website at bartdehrman.com. You're listening to Talkish, the Hallie Kesser-Jane Show. My guests today are Bart D. Ehrman, the author of The Triumph of Christianity, and Rabbi Michael Bernholtz. Talkish with Hallie Kesser-Jane posts new podcasts Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern at HallieKesserJane.com and via all your favorite apps. And we are available on your Alexa device, too. Let me introduce Rabbi Michael Bernholtz. Rabbi Bernholtz arrived at Temple Beth Shalom in Vero Beach, Florida in 2002, following his ordination from Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion. Over the years that Rabbi Bernholtz has been in Indian River County, Florida, he's enthusiastically shared his Rosh and Kosh, spirit and strength, with the many diverse generations and facets of the Jewish community, as well as with the area community at large. He has participated in a wide variety of opportunities to teach and preach Jewish values and wisdom, not only to his congregation, but to the diverse community. Judaism, religion, spirituality, anti-Semitism, Passover. It's time for Talkish. Let's talk with Rabbi Michael Bernholtz. So, Rabbi, I want to talk to you about the triumph of Judaism. And maybe that's not the right word. It's survival, maybe. How do you see the fact that against all odds, Jews and Judaism are still here?
Well, maybe it's the Meshuggah of Judaism, a little bit of the craziness, or maybe the chutzpah of Judaism. I think that's been incredible, that survival and that ability to keep moving and to get through and around and over and above different obstacles throughout history is part of the power of Judaism.
I like the words that you used. I want to define Judaism. You know, I think that a lot of non-Jews really don't have a clue who Jews are and what their basic tenet of belief. I mean, the word that comes between many religions and Judaism is Jesus. What would you say? How would you define Judaism?
So one of the best definitions I've seen is faith family. Because there's aspects of religion and faith in it, and then there's also these aspects of family, of tribe, of culture. that are with it too. And Judaism is this faith family that grew out of one of our ancient ancestors, Abraham and Sarah. As we tell the story through Torah, that they had connected with the divine in a very particular way. And then over the generations, there were various covenants that were formed between Abraham and Sarah and God, and then all of their descendants and God as they move through history. And the different things that you see that come through Judaism is that the goal of Judaism is to make the world a better place, number one, and then number two, create both a community and individuals that are living to their highest moral and intellectual potential.
That is a cultural thing. That is not political. And I bring that up because lately I have been hearing talks of, you say the word community, and you get back socialism, or you get back some weird things with that. Can you, there's anything that you could say on that subject?
Well, a community is a group of people interacting with each other. And Judaism's always seen itself as a communal structure, that you have individuals who are living out the story of connection between God and Abraham, but then it's built from those individuals working with families, working with community. You'll hear a term called minyan, that you need to have 10, and in the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, there's actually a time when Abraham is arguing with God over what will rescue the city from destroying itself, and the answer becomes 10 people engaged in the betterment of the city. And so it's community. It's a group of people all working out the story, its sense of time, its sense of culture, faith, religion, language, food, all of those different things, trying to both make themselves better and also make the world a better place.
Is that different than the main other religions?
Well, within any of these different religions, you're going to have people that are defining it in different ways. I certainly have, in my experience, I've come across Christian communities functioning in that way, Muslim communities functioning in that way. And so I think among all different these different religious groups, you're going to find them building communities in similar ways.
Yeah, I do like the word community, and I'm glad to see that word has become a major part of our lexicon these days. Maybe we got away from that, and that's not a good thing. So you're a rabbi in a relatively small town, Vero Beach, Florida. Not a lot of Jews in Vero Beach, Florida, changing a little bit. I suspect many would be surprised to learn that there is even a temple in Vero. So talk to me about this, because I think that your experience isn't all that different than a lot of other rabbis who are in the diaspora. What's the experience for you as a rabbi in a small, predominantly non-Jewish community? Can we all get along?
I've seen lots of times where people get along that are supportive of each other. And it's huge and it's powerful. The more times I engage in interfaith cooperation and interfaith dialogue, how much stronger it makes my sense of connection to my own religious faith, my understanding of my own religious story, by seeing other people process their own religious experiences and being able to wrestle back and forth with each other about how do we make sure that we're connecting in a meaningful way with our experience and our religious traditions.
It must be interesting to speak to the other faith leaders in the community. Do you work together to foment some kind of a bridge between all the different groups that you come across? In an age when, I'm going to say this, Rabbi, anti-Semitism is clearly on the rise, not just here, but everywhere. Just recently, a French Jewish woman who had survived the Holocaust was stabbed and burned by her Muslim neighbor. Talk to me about that and living in a neighborhood where there are many.
Well, the challenges of being in a small town is, number one, there's less of a critical mass of Jewish community to create Jewish opportunities for experience. That's one of the things we see. And the second thing is that there are people that don't have as many experiences with Jewish people or Jewish tradition. And so in Vero, in part, it's because it's such a small town, it's very monolithic in culture and outlook. And so it's a lot of folks in Vero don't have a lot of experience with other, whether the other is somebody of a different race or a different religion. And so that's one of the biggest things is people aren't used to when they start talking about religious community, their default is church because there aren't a lot of religious communities that aren't church in this area.
How do you bridge that gap? How is part of the role as rabbi, by the way, the word rabbi, teacher, right? I mean, virtually,
I am not holier than anybody else. I teach about Judaism, and I lead a lot of our rituals because of my education.
Right, that I understand. So when you run across, which I'm sure you do, being viewed upon as the other, how do you respond?
I just bring the Judaism that I know that talks about making the world a better place, about looking for holiness in the world, and about taking care of humans around us. Tomorrow I'll have an opportunity to go and do the invocation at the county commission, and the day after that I'll be at one of the private schools here. They're doing a whole interfaith program about religion and identity that I'll participate in. And so that's part of the answer, is I find ways to be as present and active in the wider community, to bring the presence of Jewish community out into the wider community, and be able to teach from our Jewish value and our Jewish stories.
I want to go back to anti-Semitism for a second and what happened in Paris, what's happening all over Europe, and certainly what's happening here. Are you concerned?
There are moments of concern, and I don't know that it matters what the generation is. We just were in the midst of Passover, in the midst of the story of what Pharaoh did in Egypt, using xenophobia, using fear of the other, using intolerance as a way of getting political power. That was a story 4,000 years ago. Here we are in our own time, where you can see people trying to divide the community and divide the world, trying to get people to respond to polarities, looking for ways of dividing and conquering, and looking for scapegoats for all of their problems in the world. And so we see it in this world, and then you see it in the past, and I'm called on as from my faith and tradition to be an upstander about how do we work together, and how do, when people seek to polarize or see people seek to dehumanize other, how can we make sure we're protecting the people who are vulnerable in our world?
I think the best place to go after that would be to morality and ethics. Are we failing in that? Or is society given its way to not upstanding, not being moral? Anything goes. Is that dangerous? Talk to me.
I think our biggest problem is that a lot of times we look at the world and we say it's somebody else's problem. I think people have a strong sense of spirituality, and I think they have a strong sense of ethics. It doesn't always get played out as necessarily a connection to an organized religion, and that's where you see our world becoming more secular. I don't think it's necessarily in Israel. They say that it's very secular because most of the Jews in Israel don't necessarily act out their Judaism by going to synagogue or being in a formal religious institution, but the religion and the culture is embedded into their daily life. I think that happens for a lot of folks, that they don't necessarily belong to a religious organization, and in part because one of the things I hear is they see a lot of hypocrisy in religious organizations. And so there is secularization. I think there's a lot of, especially with the internet, especially with the way our media and our technology works, there are places where I think it's the same ethics. I think people's ethical choices get displayed a lot faster and a lot further very quickly. In the same breath, I think it's the same human tapestry, where people are really struggling for an hour, and a day by day to make meaningful choices to take care of themselves, to take care of their families, to take care of their children, and take care of the world.
When you see kids today, which you do, in synagogue and with the different programs for young Jewish kids, do you see a difference in those kids? Or because they're there, you're assuming the parents like to see a religious education for their children, and the children or how we all were as kids, you know, going to Hebrew school, doing whatever, liking it not so much, but glad as adults that we were given that background. Do you see anything different there?
The biggest thing is technology. The technology has really changed how we interact and communicate with each other. And like anything in our world, it has its pluses and minuses. The ability to communicate, I can go on my computer and have a web conversation and video conference with people in Israel. I can work with rabbis from all over the country on a web conference. I can share resources with a colleague or with a student. So I think the technology has both its the social media parts of it, the way that kids can communicate so quickly, the choices they're forced to make sometimes at a much younger age, that all gets intensified in the same breath. Our ability to heal, care for each other, reach out and connect with each other has been greatly amped up. So I don't. I think the issues are the same. The way that we can interact with each other has changed.
So back to Judaism as a religion, but back to Judaism as a spiritual religion. And I would say this of Christianity, of Catholicism, are we losing the spiritual aspects of religion? Is that a problem?
Can you ask one more time? I'm not sure I followed that.
Okay. I'm saying that there is religion and there's organized religion, which has kind of taken it, you know, on the chin a little bit from people. And then there's spirituality that's taught within the religion. I mean, and surely you understand the difference between religion and the spiritual aspects of religion, particularly in Judaism. Yes?
So in Judaism, it's interesting. There's two terms. One is keva, which means the structure, the concrete something. It's like the balloon. And kavanah, which is the breath you breathe into the balloon. That's the creativity, the spirituality, the intention. And Judaism sees the two of them working in concert with each other. A story is the keva. That's the concrete. How you tell it, in what context, what values you bring out, that's the kavanah. And both of them have to be working in concert with each other. If it's all spirit with no structure behind it, without that sense of connection with other people, without that shared dialogue, it loses something. And if it's all ritual, if it's all action, if it's all law, and it doesn't include help you be inspired and empowered in your spirituality, it's losing something. And so it's a dynamic system going back and forth between the two. That Judaism as an organized religion is giving you a sense of time, it's giving you a direction of action so that you can bring your spirit forward.
It's spring. It's Passover.
Mm-hmm.
The story of Passover is certainly one of triumph, and we're talking triumph here. It's also a story of miracles. Talk to us about the universal message to the story of Passover.
Well, the universal message is very simple. The Hebrew word for Egypt is Mitzrayim, which means a stuck and narrow place. And the universal message is that we all find ourselves in stuck and narrow places. When we tell the story of the Exodus from Egypt, it's speaking to us as a wider community. How do we relive that experience so that we're inspired to make sure that we ourselves are free and that we're making sure other people are able to live out to their fullest potential? And in the same breath, that we as individuals are really thinking about the places where we're stuck. In fact, right now we're in a period of time where we're shifting from Passover, we're in the midst of Passover, but we've also started something called the counting of the Omer, that every day you're supposed to count a day, and we go from Passover, from the Exodus from Egypt, and we go towards Mount Sinai. And that as we're making that march, that we're counting each day over that 50 days. It's the observance of the giving of Torah at Mount Sinai is called Shavuot or Shavuos. And that is the Hebrew for weeks, because it's a week of weeks. And in Christianity, they have a similar time frame for their story with Jesus, with Pentecost. And there's a Jewish counting of our own that goes from Egypt going towards Mount Sinai. And the goal of it is, as you count those 50 days, what are the little changes that you make each day in the way you move through the world, the way you look at the world, how you physically, emotionally, and spiritually move, so that by the time our community arrives to celebrate coming to Mount Sinai once again, that anniversary, and that we are really ready to stand in that place that is high and holy. And I say anniversary, and part of me says anniversary, and part of me says that we relive, because every year we're reliving that experience of standing at Mount Sinai and taking our inheritance of Torah seriously.
Poetic. You made the Wall Street Journal, am I right?
What was that?
Did you make the Wall Street Journal, or did a Wall Street Journal report do a story on you?
I ended up connecting with the Wall Street Journal. I do a number of biblical garden programs here, and I ran into a reporter from the Wall Street Journal and told her all about my garden failures, and that caught her attention. And so I got into the Wall Street Journal for my biblical gardening and for the fact that I wasn't very good at it. But so it was an exciting moment, and the garden is a perfect example We have our garden projects, and the garden is for two things. One is there's tons of Jewish values about taking care of the garden, of taking care of the earth. But then there's also the way that the garden teaches us how to connect with Jewish values of hospitality, Jewish values of being kind and caring to other people, Jewish values of understanding the flow of time. So we see it's both and. It's both how do we take care of the garden, but how does in taking care of the garden help us understand how to be the best human beings we can.
He has the most fabulous garden I've seen it, guys. And although he says it's a failure, it's quite a lovely spot in the middle of a lot of chaos in the world, I have to say. And you went and you got your what do you call it when you get your master's of horticulture?
Oh, I'm a master garden volunteer, so I help with the county extension. And now I know why I'm killing stuff in the garden. I haven't gotten doing less.
It's fantastic, though. It's really great. And I'm going to help you with that. I swear I am. I love that whole concept of it. And I love that that's something that we can all do in our own backyards, really, if you want, is to build your own biblical garden. You know, we're all looking for a little bit of peace. Isn't that what a garden is really about, too? Heaven, community, the gentleness of life, a oneness. But these days, Rabbi, but it's hard to find. There's a lot of crazy and a lot of chaos. And I'm wondering what you say to all of that.
Well, I think the response to the chaos is how do we bring chesed, which is kindness, rachamim, which is compassion, and chen, which is grace. How do we bring kindness and compassion and grace into the world? We know that if you walk into a place and you bring a non-anxious presence or a less anxious presence to it, you have the power to calm it down. You see that time and again. And we never know exactly what we do that's going to make a huge difference, but doing those things can't hurt.
Could you talk to me, and this is a throwback to maybe part of the earlier conversation, but I did want to bring it up, and I have it in my notes, and I just saw it, and I said, yeah, I'm not going to let this one go. Let's talk about it. You talked to me about pluralism the other day. We were talking about something. You want to talk about that?
Well, certainly. I mean, for me, as I am doing the interfaith dialogue work that I do, that's part and parcel of pluralism, that pluralism to me is contrasted with chauvinism. Chauvinism says that I have a particular point of view. Mine is the only one that's correct, and I'm whether it's religion, whether it's gender, and I'm going to oppress everybody else that doesn't follow my lead or doesn't find my perspective. Versus pluralism that says there's values that we hold in common, values of taking care of each other, value of the dignity of every person. Those common and shared values, what's important, and that within pluralism, the reality is that there might be multiple stories, there might be multiple approaches in order to reach those values and live out those values. One of my, somebody from the Christian community is telling a very different story. They're telling the story of Jesus the Messiah. I don't believe Jesus is the Messiah. It doesn't mean that the way I move through Judaism isn't going to bring peace to the world. They can be having their observance of Easter and their Pentecost. I'm doing Passover in my sense of Shavuot, and we can still be bringing peace and kindness and caring to the world.
So as a rabbi, leave us with this. Leave us in these fractious times, in these difficult times, as we are all, of all faiths, into the spring of our religious year. Talk to me about what you can leave us with in terms of a spiritual message.
Well, the simple thing is in the spring you have a chance for renewal and rebirth, and that during the winter everything comes to a rest, and that as we take that rest and now we're emerging in spring, how do we want the world to look? How do we want that new growth to look? What direction do we want to take? Whether we're caring for the garden or we see ourselves as the new growth in the garden, and that this is a chance for a real renewal. And do we want any garden is healthier when you have the diversity of people and energy, when it's a real ecosystem. And so we have a chance to see that bigger ecosystem, and we have a chance to contribute our own little piece of it. And that as we march through the spring and we find that sense of renewal, and it's day by day, hour by hour, and day by day. We don't have to somehow save the entire world, but we have a chance to make our little impact to make it a better place.
The one word that we really didn't discuss was God.
Well, that's because people have different senses of connection with the divine and with God, that sense of something greater than themselves. And some people find that sense of something greater looking at human community, and other people see it in divine books. And so we have all sorts of different names and languages and ways of talking with God. And to me, it's not so much which God we're talking about or which theology, but how that theology, that sense of connection, drives us to take care of people around us and make us the best human beings we can be.
Rabbi, thanks so much for your time. Next year in Jerusalem?
Next year in Jerusalem.
I've been speaking with Rabbi Michael Bernholtz. When you're in Vero Beach, Florida, stop by for a visit to Temple Beth Shalom and to view the extraordinary biblical garden on the temple's campus. Thank you so much for tuning in to Talkish with Hallie Castor-Jane, the Hallie Castor-Jane Show, a production of Resec LLC. Be sure to tune in to Talkish Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern, when new podcasts are posted at HallieCastorJane.com and on all your favorite apps. We are open 24/7. So, until next time, when we meet again, this is Hallie Castor-Jane.